today, what we're going to do is we're going to cover another area of revolution. This would be a revolutionary area that would spark significant political change and would create a ripple, hit the door, that would have lasting effects and continues to this day. It's a period of time known as the Enlightenment, sometimes referred to as the Age of Reason. What happened was, in the wake of the scientific revolution and the agricultural revolution and the development of the industrial revolution, people started applying scientific methodology to those institutions of human society. Why? Well, very simple. They looked around and they realized, okay, there's lots of problems. There are things necessarily that we don't like. Well, if we can change the way we produce food, and if we can change the way we produce goods, maybe we can change the way we have society. At its core was politics. It was a political philosophy aimed at trying to elevate humanity from the circumstances in which Europe was in the 17th and early 18th centuries. And just as the scientists in the scientific revolution developed mathematical methodologies, just like Lord Bacon encouraged empiricism, well, the people involved in this movement would do the same. They argued that all human beings have a brain, and from that brain, it gives them the ability to reason. Well, you could use that ability to observe the way things work in society. Commonly referred to as natural law, which was another way of saying God's law. You know, the way that order and reality operates. And once you do that, once you see how things work, and if you find there are problem areas, then you can fix them. Hence, you can progress. You can improve. To give you a simple analogy, if you have a flat tire on your car, you don't continue to drive on it. No, you stop, you change the tire, and then you drive. Deduce the problem, understand how things work, fix it, zoom, off you go. Well, the people involved in this movement simply argue, look at our history. Look at all the stuff we just covered in this class. We barely scratched the surface. And there were a lot of bad things going on that involved human beings. Well, maybe if we use our brains, we can see those past mistakes and fix them. And as we do that, maybe we can improve society. And if we keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it, it might be possible to create a perfect society. Which they referred to as utopia. Of course, we know what utopia actually means. We covered it already. The actual Greek word utopia means, does anyone remember? All right, what do you think the word utopia means?
Perfect society.
Perfect society. Can you create a perfect society? No. But should you stop trying to get there? No. They acknowledge that making perfection is impossible, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
Interestingly enough, all of the things that we talked about before, for the most part, the leaders of these movements were either members of the clergy or members of nobility. And they usually did their books to get something out of it. But the people that emerged during this time period, these philosophers, they were not out for personal gain. They were true adherents to philosophy, the science of thinking, of reasoning. And of course, they were commonly referred to as the philosophes, which is nothing more than the French word for philosophers. Of course, this does not mean they were all French. That's not the case. Many were not French, but some were. And that does not mean that they were all philosophers by true definition. Some were, but not all. Some were just critics. So they'd write something criticizing something that they saw and they didn't like. Some were publicists, you know, so they were trying to sell a copy. Some were economists. Some were political scientists. Some were just social reformers. But what you had was a time period of a whole bunch of people just writing books and publishing them with arguments for and against everything that was in society. Now, ironically, most were not particularly optimistic. Most basically recognized that, you know, there is no more flawed creature on earth than mankind. They believed that the majority of people were incapable of actually fixing their problems. Why? Because they didn't use this properly. Or they let emotion cloud their judgment. But the greatest thing about this was that it didn't stop them from writing. They wrote for the sense of sharing their ideas. And if you didn't agree with what they had to say, c'est la vie. Questions so far? All right. Ironically, as I said, this began as a political movement. Politics. Arguing for policy. And the political roots date back to what we talked about for the tail end of exam number 3. They looked back in their recent past and they surveyed the events that took place on both sides of the English Channel in the 1680s. On one hand, you had Louis XIV, the Sun King, revoking the Edict of Nantes, not allowing for toleration, using his military to impose tyranny on his people, crushing anyone who stood in his way, versus James II in England, who wanted to do that. But in the end, as we know, he triggered so much resentment that his own people turned him against him and drove him out in the Glorious Revolution. So as they compare and contrast both situations and the outcomes, these philosophers simply argue. France and Louis, that's bad. Who in their right mind would want to live in that society? Where if you wanted to make cupcakes, you had to go to the crown and get his permission. If you wanted to have your own thoughts, you wanted to go to your own church, nope, you could not do that. You had to do what the king told you. That equals bad. Versus what the English did. Glorious Revolution. William and Mary, come in, sign the Bill of Rights. All people in England, free speech, trial by jury, habeas corpus, all of those things we talked about. That results in individual liberty, freedom. So ipso facto, simple math. If you live in a tyrannical state and you don't want to live under a tyranny, you have a revolution. You overthrow the system and put something new in. Now, by the way, they weren't saying bloodletting, chaos, mass destruction, genocidal events. They were simply talking about something similar to what happened in England. It was a bloodless revolution. Not a single Shah was fired. The people simply rose up and essentially fired their king. And they put someone in who was better, that would protect their rights. Questions? All right, well, who was it that came up with this formula? My favorite critical philosopher, John Locke. John Locke was one of the first men who was alive during the Glorious Revolution to defend it. He was the first person to argue that the people have an inherent right to overthrow tyranny. That the people, from God, have certain rights. And that the state cannot interfere in those rights. Any of you ever read part or all of his second treatise on government? It's a hard book, I'll admit it. But it's a valuable book. Because this was one of the most important books that inspired our founding fathers when they decided to rebel against the crown. In this, Locke establishes a few laws, natural laws. The first I already said that all people, by nature, are free, equal, and independent. That all people, by nature, by God, the great creator, gives us all freedom, equality, independence. And that the people choose to give up some of their rights to live in an organized society. So instead of having however many people we have in our country, 350 million or so people, running around doing their own things at all circumstances, no. We willingly give up some of our freedom, our independence, to live in a place where you don't have to worry about our houses blowing up because our neighbor wants to kill us. In other words, we submit to government. We submit to the rule of law. But you know what this is not based on? The whole foundation of absolutism, divine rights. We choose to give up some of our freedom, our independence, our liberty. Not God. This was the foundation, what became known as the social contract. What's contract?
Binding agreement.
Binding agreement between?
Two parties.
That does what? It's a binding agreement between two parties. Well, what is the purpose of the contract?
Someone gets something in exchange for
another. Yeah. Quid pro quo. Both parties get something out of the deal. All right. So here's the gap. By submitting to governmental authority, the people get safety. To make it simple, protection, rights, etc. What does the government get? Okay, that's fine. Taxes, that's fair. But where should the taxes go? Go back to the people, yeah. Taxes, power. Authority, whatever. Just a recognition that they're in charge. Now, in a perfect society, the government only passes laws that protect the rights of the people, that secures them in their person, their homes, their properties. No more. That's it. That's the perfect society. Government only exists to do just enough so that way we're all safe. How do you get into a contract? How is a contract created?
And have you had like any contract law here?
One person makes an offer, the other party accepts, and this consideration that kind of binds it. But this is the promise to do both. So the key is consent. And who gives consent? The people. Because it's the people who creates government. Now, by the way, Locke points out consent isn't a one-time thing. You know, just because of your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents agreed to the government that was there, doesn't mean that you agree to it. No, you consciously choose. Every generation chooses, gives their consent to what the government does. And if the government does what it's supposed to do, you have a good society. But what happens if there's a violation? What happens if there is a breach? The contract becomes void. So the system no longer works. Now, what happens if an individual in society breaches the terms of the deal? Obeying the laws made by the government. What happens to an individual person?
Punishment.
Punishment. Punishment under the law. And of course, in the United States, it could be fines, it could be imprisonment, and in some places in our country, it could be death. What happens if the government breaches? What happens if the government breaches the terms of the deal? Overthrow, alter, slash, abolish. Locke said, so long as the government protects the interests of the people, so long as the government does what it's supposed to do, the people should follow the law. But if the government fails to protect the people, and by the way, this does not mean one or two or three. If the government doesn't protect the majority of people, that is justification to eliminate the government, to remove those in power. Again, go back to what James was doing. He was acting like a Catholic. He was ignoring all the Protestants. He was bringing in Catholic ministers. He was building a standing army. He was ignoring the laws of Parliament. All of those institutions which were there to protect the people. So, he had to go. Questions? Well, interestingly enough, Locke didn't stop there. Locke also continued on. In another important essay, also published in 1690, called The Essay Concerning Human Understanding. He was one of the first philosophers that argued that any person has the ability to learn virtue. Virtue, of course, being proper behavior. And from virtue comes rationality. In other words, in order to think reasonably, you have to have a foundation. You have to have a moral compass. You must know what's right and what's wrong. If you have no morality, your sense of right and wrong is going to be askew to society. Now, considering the time that he lived in, there was still the church basically saying that, think of Calvinism. You know, that there were people that was basically born to be lost. That they were lost souls, that they could never be reformed. That they were going to hell. Women were not allowed to participate in many aspects of society. Why? Well, because they were women. And they were deemed to be irrational.
But in comes John Locke and says, no. No. All people. All people. Regardless of class, regardless of gender, regardless of ethnicity, whatever phrase you want to put in there. All people have one thing in common. They are all born the same.
When you, out of mom,
there was nothing going on up in here.
Your brain was, as he referred to it, in a state of tabula rasa,
which means blank slate.
Just like the whiteboard before I started writing on it. It was clean. It was unmarked. And if you pursued the foundations of reason, you could soon get that moral compass that would give you virtue, which would give you the ability to act and engage in reasonable thoughts and actions. But here's something interesting. He linked it all this way. How do you know when you know something? Where do you get that knowledge from? He said, not only is it innate, your ability to process, but you also learn from your environment, those who you choose to surround yourselves with. Well, if you put these two together, you can know things. And once you know things, you can kind of see the writing that's on the wall. No pun intended. But here is the key point. Can it be forced on you? And Locke said no.
The only thing holding us back is ourselves. We all have the ability to learn.
All. Emphasis. And I'm not trying to be politically correct. He was one of the first philosophers to argue that any person who was born and has a pulse has the ability to learn. And once you learn, you can see the way things work. And once you see the things work, you can fix the things that are wrong.
Questions? All right, what about the whole Catholic versus Protestant thing?
Which again, happened generations before he was born. But it was still recent memory, just like we recall World War I, World War II.
During the end of the 1600s, they were still aware of the impact of the wars of religion.
Well, that same year he also wrote another letter
concerning toleration.
And he looked at the events of the wars of the religion and he said, you know what caused these wars to be so violent, so destructive? Was all of them began when the government was trying to tell people what to believe. 30 Years' War. Ferdinand II. Oh, I don't like the fact that Bohemia has a Protestant king. So let's go wipe them all out so they will believe what I want them to believe.
Well, in his letter, he looked to Scripture. And he acknowledged that nowhere in the Bible does it say that God gives his consent to allow one man to force their religion onto another.
In other words, nobody has the right to tell you what you have to think. Because, by the way, By this point, by the age of reason, religion was not linked to organizations. It was not linked to, like, the Catholic Church. That wasn't a religion. Religion was reference to your own faith, your own capacity to have consciousness. It appears not that God has ever given any such authority to one man over another as to compel anyone to his religion. Well, if God doesn't give consent to a man, God also cannot give consent to the state controlling religion. Bless you.
Thank you.
And again, it's not institutions. We're not talking particular churches, hierarchies, and so forth. We're talking about the state of faith and consciousness and values and all of those things that all religions have in common. So if God doesn't give one man the power to force, God definitely doesn't give the state the power to force. So then what should the state be doing? Going back to the social contract. He argued the only thing that the state has a right to do is to safety, protection, rights, etc. To protect the lives, the liberties, the health, the property of all of the people that make up society. That's it. Can the government pick favorites? No. Legitimate government must treat all people the same. Revolutionary. But how do you get there? How do you get from having a monarch who's an absolutist to the point when people basically actually have the biggest say in society and government only exists to protect the people's interests? Well, Locke, going back to everything we just said, was one of the first people to say they must learn how. And this is the significance of the Age of Reason. In responding to claims that all people have the capacity to learn, the philosophers, the philosophers, all in all of their works were not trying to tell you what to think, but rather were trying to be the chalk on the blank slate to give you the ability to process. It wasn't a mandate. They weren't telling you this was the absolute truth. But rather they were giving you the ability to sit back and say, oh yeah, I kind of agree with this. Or, oh yeah, I kind of don't. So, if these teachers could teach men how to think properly, and women, there's your reason. And once you get that reason, you can figure out the laws of nature, and then you can progress. Question? Now, the three primary areas that the philosophers talked about were the three things that were that ultimately interfere with everyone's lives the most. At the time, institutional religion, politics, and economics. Those are the three broad areas that they talked about. Now, we don't have time to talk about every single one of the philosophers in every single one of the categories. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the big ones, and I'm going to give you an example of two of each of the slots. Religion, politics, economics. Starting with religion. Why? I don't know. That's just the way it is in my notes. Probably should have done it alphabetically. Silly. All right. When you do any type of research on the Age of Reason, there is one name that you will stumble upon. Because he is one of the giants associated with the Enlightenment. Voltaire. Voltaire was not his name, it was a pen name. He had to write anonymously because if he put his actual name to paper, he was living during the reign of Louis XV, the government would have tracked him down and probably had him arrested and jailed. Put on trial for treason. So he had to write under a pseudonym. And his identity wasn't determined until after he died. But he wrote lots of books. And ironically, right out of the gates, one of his most controversial ones was when he wrote a book called The Philosophical Letters Concerning the English Nation, in which he literally did what we did at the beginning. He compared British and French societies. And he actually said that the English, the enemy to his people, for hundreds of years, were actually the superior society. Why? They had freedom of thought. They had freedom of thought. France, on the other hand, was inferior. Look at me. I gotta write a book, and I can't even use my own name, because I might get my head cut off.
Pretty controversial. That would be like if, I don't know if you get an analogy. That would be like if you have a situation where somebody basically starts arguing, you know, that Iran, we should become like Iran, or we should become like North Korea. People would be like, dude! Although luckily in our society, you can't get your head around. Although, ironically, if you go to North Korea and you argue, oh, we should be like America, then you will basically be disappeared. Which, of course, proves his point. But this had nothing to do with religion, but this would be the first book that allowed his name to rise. And then once he wrote this first book, he continued to write. He wrote many books. One of my favorite was, one of the easiest ones to read was Candide. But he, other his books, Plato's Dream, Zadig, etc. There's a whole bunch of them. But in his various works, he did something that was shocking. He talked about all of the horrors of his lifetime. Things that were occurring on a day-by-day basis. He talked about wars, he talked about famine, he talked about natural disasters. Then he did that, and with a highly sarcastic tone, he juxtaposed those situations with the positions of people who are blind in their faith. Particularly the people that believe in all things God wills it. Deus vult. Okay, wait. We have this war that was started because one king wanted a little bit more land. What does that have to do with God? We have this natural disaster. Disasters that happen all the time have always happened everywhere on earth. What do you think, just because a lightning bolt comes down and strikes your tree in your yard, that God wants to blow you up? Famines, death, deaths of innocents. And the central question in all of his books was this. When you read about those horrors, it's always the innocent who die. Always the innocent who die. If life is perfect and human existence is perfect, and this is true in a utopian society, why do so many innocents die? One of the most effed up things that I hear about on the news is when you hear those stories about gangbangers tormenting sections of inner cities and randomly going out and popping caps in people's asses. But there's always a story once or twice a week that comes out of places like Chicago or Detroit. A little kid in their bedroom, sleeping, playing with their toys. Bullet comes to the wall and kills them. That's messed up. Why did that innocent child die? I don't think that was God's will. Voltaire began to mock organized religion, the rules of the Catholic Church, the rules of the Lutheran Church, the rules of Islam, and so forth. Going so far as to say famously, and I quote, "Theology amuses me. That's where we can find the madness of the human spirit in all its plenitude." But here's the funny thing. And this goes to what I said before, that most of the philosophers didn't believe people could figure it out. Voltaire, writing almost 300 years ago, simply acknowledged that, yeah, religion is crazy, but it's a necessary crazy. Because the truth is, the majority of people need to fear the eternal punishment so that way they behave. As he said, and I quote, "Man has always needed a break," as in your car. If God did not exist, he would have to be invented. Okay, what about the holy books? The Bible, the Torah, the Quran. He basically referred to them all collectively, but he went after the Bible in particular. He said that, what is the Bible? That's not history. He argued that the Bible was nothing but moral references. That it's like a metaphor. Now granted, there are some good lessons to be learned in there. Like, you know, kind of being kind to one another. But ultimately, he argued, this book was not actually made from God. It didn't descend from the heavens and magically appear. No, the Bible was written by a human being. And if it was written by a human being, does that mean it's the absolute truth? So, summing things up, he repeatedly called for toleration among all of the faiths. In talking directly about the horrors and the atrocities of the wars of religion that racked Europe for 100 years and continued into his time, just not on the same scale. He said, and I quote, "There is scarce any city or borough in Europe where blood has not been spilt for religious quarrels. I say that Europe would have had a population 1/3 larger if there had been no theological disputes." Blind faith causes people to do bad things. Question. So that's great. He's tearing down the philosophical, the religious, the moralistic foundations of Western civilization. What's his alternative then? Because if you're going to destroy something, you have to come up with an alternative. Well, Voltaire and many of the other philosophers that talked about religion did come up with an alternative. And today it is referred to as deism. Deism derives from the Latin word for God, Deus. Deists, among whom you could include Thomas Jefferson, believed that God was in fact the creator, because something cannot come from nothing. There has to be a starting point. So deists acknowledged that there was something. And again, we're not talking just the Christian or the Islamic version of what God is.
When the deists refer to God, they refer to it almost like a force. Something caused that spark.
Well, they argued, once creation was made, God was more like a watchmaker as opposed to a puppeteer. Meaning, like a watchmaker. Not like the digital ones that are made with like mass-produced machines. We're talking the old wind-up watches. Where somebody had to be an expert and handcraft every last part, every spring, every gear, and carefully place them in order and encase it. And once the watchmaker makes his creation and winds it up, it starts going tick, 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 tick. He then sells it. And the watch is gone. The watch exists, but he has no control. As opposed to the people who view the creator as a puppet master who controls everything. Now, they're not atheists. Those associated with deism do not believe there is no higher being. But what they were doing is they were arguing for a natural religion. Something similar to what we talked about with Bruno, where he basically said all of the theological rules should be scrapped and should be based on a scientific view of God's creation, nature. Because after all, someone had to create the earth. Someone had to create those mechanisms in which existence operates. But the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, that talked about divine intervention and God speaking down onto earth. Deists claim that's all wrong. Why? Very simple. Did Jesus write his own book? Did Muhammad write his own book? Did King David or Adam or Noah, did they write their own books? All of the stories that come from the Holy Scriptures were all written by other people much later after the time the events occurred. So, what proof exists that when Muhammad was out in the desert on the mountain, that the archangel Gabriel came down and spoke to him?
Well, here's the key. Well, if there is no God, how can there be divine rights?
Questions. Right. Politics. For politics, I'm going to give you two examples because there were two alternatives to monarchies that were proposed during the Age of Reason. The first derives from Montesquieu. Montesquieu in 1748 wrote a book known as The Spirit of the Laws. This would be a criticism of the French government. Not attacks on the individuals that were in the offices necessarily, but just an attack on the system as a whole. And maybe it really wasn't even an attack. Maybe it was just suggestions about tweaks that could be made. One of the biggest things that he argued was for separation of power. The government system created, beginning with Cardinal Richelieu, and then perfected during the reign of Louis XIV, absolutism, allows the king to control everything. The king makes the laws, the king enforces the laws, and the king makes judgment under the law. Well, that is good for the government, particularly the king, but that is definitely not good for the people. Because what happens if, for whatever reason, the king just doesn't like you? Will you get justice? No. So what he argued was that the powers of government, the three basic powers, making the law, enforcing the law, and adjudication, judgment under the law, should be separated and held by different branches. He said there should be a legislative branch that makes the laws, and that there should be an executive branch. And by the way, he was okay with it being a king. But all that the king should do is enforce the laws made by the legislative branch. And that there should be independent judges appointed. So that way, when the king enforces the law, what happens if the king, you know, does something a little off? Well, you don't want to see innocent people being punished. In other words, he was arguing, instead of allowing the government to work for the government, let's make the government work for the people. And how do you do it? You have the government make laws through a legislative process and make the laws apply to everybody, even the government. And if you do that, essentially you could have the guarantee of safety and protection and rights and so forth. Well, in this book, he also looked at a whole bunch of different types of governments, monarchies, republics, democracies. And he simply argued that the republic was the best. The republic first advocated by Plato, where there is a legislative body made up of representatives of the people. And those representatives, if they're in the legislative branch, will make laws that are good for them. If you had a king, a good king, well, his tendency for abuse will be checked on his ability to stay on the throne. Because if he didn't enforce the laws of the people, again, look what happened in England. Plus, the crown is historic. The crown is a symbol which unifies the people. So we could have a monarchy ahead of the republic. What about democracy? What about absolute monarchy? Well, he basically said anything else is basic enslavement. Whether you are enslaved to the one or you are enslaved to the mob. Either way, the rights will not be protected in any other form of system. Which, coincidentally, is the reason why our founding fathers gave us a republic, because of his book. We don't live in a democracy. Because just as Montesquieu argued that democracy would result in mob rule, that's what our founding fathers believed. Questions? All right, well, what about the democracy thing? Well, there was all the forms of government slavery. There was actually somebody who argued for democracy. And just 14 years later, in 1762, Rousseau would publish a book known as The Social Contract. In it, he looked to history as well, going all the way back to ancient Greece. And he argued for what today we would call Athenian democracy. Pure majoritarianism, like they had in the Greek states, where basically all of the citizens would be allowed to vote on all of the matters, and it was all done by majority vote. He also argued, expanding upon the contract theory,
that if the people have the right to choose their government, surely the best government is the people. But here's the catch. If the government and the people are one, because the government's making the laws to protect everything, and the people must obey the government, well, if a majority, because that's how you have democracy, a true democracy is based on majoritarianism, no protection of the minority, it's only what the majority wants, then the people must obey. You have no choice. Because laws that come out of democracy are based on what he called the general will. If we were to take a vote and authorize the consumption of pineapple pizza, and if 50% of the room plus one more person said no pineapple pizza, in a democracy, there would be no pineapple pizza. The fact that you would be in the minority and you liked it does not matter. You must obey the majority. So, Rousseau argued, there's where you get your freedom. You have the freedom to obey the laws made by the majority. But if you don't, too bad. The government has the authority to force compliance. In other words, what our founding fathers all referred to when they used the word democracy, mob rule. If the mob comes for you and demands you say this, or you think that, or you do this, you have no choice. You have no protections. Coincidentally, this is why whenever you see references in the works of the Founding Fathers talking about these two books, they always said this good, this bad. Because in this system, you can pass a law to protect the minority. In this system, it's only what the majority wants. Very different, though, than monarchy. Questions? But again, both are arguing their positions, but it's up to you, the reader, to decide which one you think is best. The last area that the philosophers talked about was money, the economy, economics. The one thing that they all shared in common was the belief that government should protect one's property. Property in reference to both real estate and personal items. Because if you are allowed to own, then you have freedom. If you don't own your phones or your sweatshirts or your sneakers or your cars, if you don't own it, anyone can come and take it from you. And if anyone can take your stuff, are you free? No, that's the kind of stuff that nobles did to their peasants. And how messed up was that? Any of you ever seen the movie Braveheart? The scene when the lord came down when the peasant was having a nice, beautiful wedding? And the noble basically said, well, I'm going to take my noble's rights. And he took the virgin bride, took her up to his castle, and shagged her virginity. Because even her virginity was not hers. It was his, because he owned her. That's how messed up it was back then. Well, these philosophers are saying, no, that's not right. If you own something, it's yours. So, how do you improve on the ability of the people to have this foundation of freedom? In comes Adam Smith. Who, ironically, as was the story of Braveheart, Adam Smith just happened to be Scottish. He was a professor,
And in the time of our war for independence, Adam Smith wrote the blueprint for what would become known as capitalism. The wealth of nations. I've only been able to read this book 1.5 times. It's hard because I'm not an economist. But here are the big points. He said that perfect society is a society upon which the economy operates through what he referred to as laissez-faire capitalism. In other words, markets driven by money. Laissez-faire, hands off. That these economies should be allowed to flow unrestricted, unregulated. Because that is how wealth, prosperity, freedom is generated. If you have the ability to make something and someone wants to buy it from you and is willing to give you money, why should the government get involved? What business is it of the government's? Every now and then I go to like craft fairs and you have people that make wonderful things and they sell it for what price they think they can get. And every now and then I'll open up my wallet and give them some cash. Why? It's something that made me feel good, something I wanted to buy. And guess what? The moment I gave the person the cash, it's mine. But how do you maximize it? Well, what Wealth of Nations was an analysis of the English Industrial Revolution as it stood in the 1770s. And at this point, if you recall, when we did our little rough timeline, there were factories operating that were powered by water wheels. And you had the ability to produce goods by taking the raw materials in one side, and there were different processes that processed the goods all the way through, and it came out the other side as a finished product. Well, he argued that's how the economy should operate. By taking different processes that result in prosperity and dividing them up amongst the workers. The division of labor. In other words, if you're good at something, you should do it. So maybe you're someone who's good at knitting, but you have no idea how to make the thread. Well, you should be allowed to knit if that's what you're good at and if you can make money for it. And let somebody else make the thread. And let somebody else sell the thread. You divide up all of those steps. And guess what? The person who makes the thread will get money from the store when they take the thread and put it on the shelves. And then the store will make money when you go and buy it from them. And then when you knit it into something and you put it up on Etsy and someone buys it from you, you'll make money. 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. Everybody makes money. Capitalism, baby. And by the way, the more goods you sell, the more services you provide, the more wealth you can accumulate. And by the way, this is a natural open process that doesn't matter on who you are. Doesn't matter what your family name is. Doesn't matter what your family's history is. Doesn't matter about traditional rights and privileges that was afforded to you by the crown. If you have a skill, you can produce something, and someone wants to give you money for that, you could be any Joe Blow. But you can become fabulously rich in your lifetime. And why should the government stop you? Instead, he said, just allow the markets to flow. Supply and demand. If
prices get too high, demand will diminish, forcing the prices to come down. And if the prices come too low and the demand becomes too great and supply shrinks, prices will then go back up again. There should never be a governmental entity that determines how much something is worth or how much someone should get paid. Because after all, if you want to be successful, you'll do what's necessary to become successful.
Oh, but what could destroy an economy?
Government.
Government regulation.
If you have government making laws saying what you can buy, who you can buy it from, how much you must pay, where it must be sold, things that are not allowed. All of those regulations are doing is naturally interfering with the natural flow of economics. It's like plaque that builds up in your arteries. The more rules, the more regulations, the more plaque builds up. Eventually your heart starts to strain until it goes pop and you die. Plus, government regulation results in unfairness. Because government can put loopholes in its regulations and allow their buddies not have to pay the same level of taxes or get some other perks. And that's not fair. Government, you don't want government picking winners and losers. But he did acknowledge some interference is necessary. Some government interference is necessary. Why? Well, you have to have a value of money. You have to have some basis of the means of having a currency. You also have to have roads. You have to have infrastructure. So he also said, in a sense, that there should be some taxes, but not enough that it would allow the government to put businesses out of business. Questions? All right. Well, what does this mean? Well, again, these were not passed like scripture or gospel. These are just suggestions, opinions. And obviously, even though they didn't think the majority of people could figure it out, overall, the philosophers basically believed if they wrote enough and put enough ideas in people's heads, they would be inspired and start making small changes. And eventually those small changes could result in bigger changes, which you never know, could result in monumental changes. They felt that man, if they continued to work, could pursue utopia. They said it was possible. And the philosopher who argued it best was the man regarded as the last of all of the philosophers. Writing during the midst of the French Revolution, Condorcet published a book in 1793 called The Progress of the Human Mind. And in it, he argued that, and I quote, "Why should it be regarded as a vain enterprise to chart with some degree of probability the course of the future destiny of mankind by studying the results of past human history?" In other words, take what we're doing now and compare it to what happened previously. If we are going down the same route as the people in the past, and that route took the people in the past towards something bad, what should a smart person do? Not repeat. Again, you can see it. It's all there. History's already written. You don't want to do bad. Look what they did. Was that bad? Yes, don't do. He said, yes, utopia could be achieved. Human history is so vast, so recorded. It's all there. If you look to the past, you can create a better economy. If you look to the past and see the abuses and the violations, you could avoid that and create freedom and opportunity. Look to the past. What did England do to get their freedom? They put in a good government. They made the king sign laws, agree to constitutions, rules. So, if you want to have a good society, write all that stuff down. Enforce it. And apply it equally. Yes, 1793. He actually argued women too, as well as all races. All human beings are entitled to the same rights. But they only can get those rights if you learn to avoid the mistakes and pitfalls of the past. So, while they acknowledged human stupidity, they were essentially like prophets. And they were prophesizing for a better society. And I'm going to make the argument that while it's not perfect, it doesn't get any better than America. We are the society envisioned by the philosophers. A place where we have a constitution that was created to limit the power of the government to interfere in our lives. But also, through the Bill of Rights, forces them to protect our liberties and our freedoms. We also have separation of power, not only amongst the federal government, but between the federal government, the states, and the local governments. And any person in this country has the ability to walk into a court and get justice. Did it take us a long time to get here? Yes. Were there a lot of bumps on the way? Yes. Do we still have more territory to go? Yes. But you know something? Always remember this. There is no other country on earth where millions of people are willing to die to try to get here. Everywhere else on earth, people would rather leave than stay. America. Questions? All right. One last little area. Well, that's great. You have these countries that have monarchies. They've had monarchies forever. You've had institutional churches forever. You had controlled, regulated economies forever. How can you just suddenly say, whoop, everyone's going to be free? Well, if you do that, it becomes chaos. So, there were some philosophers that offered an alternative to deism and republics and capitalism. And those systems of government were referred to as being enlightened despots or enlightened absolutists. In other words, you could have reason, natural law, and begin progressing by having an educated, kind, caring ruler. Why? Very simple. If you have one person in power, it's easier than having thousands of people in government. Because if you have thousands of people in government, you have thousands of opinions. And if you have thousands of opinions, that could result in thousands of conflicts. But if you have the one, they can force things through. But the key is, you got to educate the one. And by the way, there were periods in time when you had good rulers. The person most responsible for developing this theory was Denis Diderot. Diderot is most famous for writing the first encyclopedia. which he attempted over a 30, 40-year span to gather all of the different ideas of all of the different philosophers and put them in one book to make it easier for the reader at home. But by going through all of these, he realized what I just said. If you had a strong, all-powerful monarch who used his force to implement rational, reasonable changes that were good for his people, then you could get to freedom quicker, easier, cleaner than a revolution. Why? Revolutions have a tendency to go off the rails. We're going to see that when we talk about the French Revolution. We're not going to talk about it in this class, but also study what happened in the Russian Revolution. Or, I don't know, so many other revolutions. The revolution just went off crazy. And the revolutionaries started killing people by the thousands and millions. So he's arguing, avoid that chaos by just letting one person just kind of force nudge everybody along in the right direction. So what do you need to do? Well, he argued you got to get rid of like censorship. You got to have more education. You got to have a freer, open economy. Encourage people to do business, to make money. And basically reduce governmental interference. Interestingly enough, historians recognize that there were actually rulers that did try. Don't write this list down. I'm not going to want you to know these. Around the same time Diderot wrote his book in which he made his arguments, there were a series of monarchs in Europe at the time. You had Frederick II of Prussia. You had Catherine II, sometimes called Catherine the Great of Russia. You had Charles III of Spain, Maria Theresa of Austria and the Holy Roman Empire, her son Joseph II, and of course Louis XV of France. During their reigns, these rulers, as all-powerful monarchs, would actually implement reforms along the lines of what Diderot were talking about. But here is the catch, and this comes from history. When you look at what they were doing, they weren't doing it for the kindness from their hearts or just love. All of the reforms had a purpose. Prussia, Russia, Austria, they were all trying to compete and catch up to the strong imperial economies of England and France. In Spain, which was no longer a global power because it was losing all of its colonies. In France, well, they wanted also to compete with England on a global level. So these monarchs didn't put reforms in because they were nice. No, they all were for a reason. And in the end, I'm not going to run out. I got to be careful. What they did was they allowed for the crowns to become more powerful by basically squashing opposition, by making it appear that they were kind and generous. Because at the end of the day, the monarchs all realized something that is an absolute truism. And this will be the last click of the day. They realized that most of the people in society are stupid, useful idiots. So if you give them a little bit, they will love you. But it's what you give them that's the key. So, for instance, Frederick II, he abolished serfdom. No longer could the Prussian nobles own the peasants. But you know something? He called the peasants citizens, but he didn't change any of the rules. So even though the nobles were still the nobles, and the peasants were now citizens, the nobles still essentially could control the citizens. So you just put a new label on it, and people are like, whoa! Joseph II liberalized publishing laws. You could write about anything you want, except you cannot criticize the crown, nor can you criticize the Catholic Church. So, what did these do? They made people feel good in the moment, like Roman bread and circus. But at the end of the day, the crowns would become stronger. And ironically, what would result is war. And we'll talk about that on Thursday. So, some of you have sent your papers. Most of you have not. The clock is ticking. Good luck.
We'll see you on Thursday.